Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Bonnie Harper, who's serving as our worship associate. Jesse Young, who has been filling in for our music director during his leave, is playing the piano this morning, and several members of the congregation, the Celtic Clan, who you've already had the pleasure of hearing this morning.
We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace. The title of today's worship service intrigued me from the moment we discussed it at the Worship Associates meeting. I thought to myself, so where is peace breaking out? I certainly don't see any evidence of it when I read the morning paper, or watch the evening news, or log on to the internet. In fact, the news stories are usually quite the opposite. My stepson works for an organization that helps children who have had their homes destroyed by war and natural disasters. And most of his assignments have been working with children who are the victims of war. So where is all this peace? Maybe I'm looking at this all wrong. I decided to consult the dictionary for some definitions of peace. One definition for peace was freedom from civil disturbance and order within a community provided by the laws. Another definition was a state of mutual concord between governments or an agreement to end hostilities between those who have been at war. However, also listed as definitions for peace were freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions, and harmony in personal relations. Is this where peace is breaking out? It certainly has potential for me. I have some control over these two meanings of peace. I can begin by searching within myself for peaceful thoughts and emotions, and I can certainly work on having peaceful personal relationships. So I'll start with peace breaking out from within myself and hope that it will grow from there. Come, let us worship together.
To lead us into a time of silence and meditation and prayer, a poem for you from William Stafford. This is from an anthology of poems about imagining peace, and this is called At the Un-National Monument Along the Canadian Border. This is the field where the battle did not happen, where the unknown soldier did not die. This is the field where grass joined hands and no monument stands, and the only heroic thing is the sky. Birds fly here without any sound, unfolding their wings across the open. No people killed or were killed on this ground, hallowed by neglect and an air so tame that people celebrate it by forgetting its name. We'll keep silence for a few moments together. Blessed Spirit of life and of love, we're trying to slow down long enough to listen to you. It's hard with work and school and family responsibilities and the chores which never seem to end. It's hard in the summertime with all of the opportunities for play and sport and festival and gathering. It's hard any time of year with struggles within our own lives, worries, fears, concerns about our health and the health of those we love, and the tragedies, little and large, which visit us and with which we must respond. Blessed Spirit of life and of love, we're trying to slow down, still ourselves long enough to listen to you. We have this moment. And And there are other moments in the quiet of the morning on the porch, in the stillness of the late evening after everyone else has gone to sleep, in the middle of the day, in a moment of rest, looking out over the lake. Maybe we hear you in the wind through the trees. Maybe we see you in the flying of the bird. Maybe we notice you in the soft spoken words of someone we love. Or maybe we feel you stirring within our own deepest selves. This we know, whenever we still slow long enough to tune in and listen to you, Spirit of Life, Spirit of Love, it makes us a little bit more peaceful, a little bit more whole, a little bit more awake and alive to this blessed life that we share. So this is our prayer today. May we find for ourselves opportunities to slow down, tune in and listen, and may the benefit of our practice be greater peace in ourselves, our families, and our communities. Amen, and blessed be.
Recipe for peace. Bare your feet, roll up your sleeve, oil the immigrant's bowl, open the doors and windows of your house, invite in the neighbors, invite in strangers off the street. Roll out the dough, add spices for a good life, cardamom and soul, cumin and tears, stir in sesame and sorrow, a dash of salt, pink as new hope. Rub marjoram and thyme, lemongrass and holy basil on your fingers and pat the dough. Bless the table, bless the bread, bless your hands and feet, bless the neighbors and strangers off the street. Bake the bread for a century or more on moderate heat, under the olive trees in your backyard, or on the sun-filled stones of Syria, in the white rocks of Beirut, or behind the walls of Jerusalem, in the mountains of Afghanistan, and in the skyscrapers of New York. Feast with all the migrant tongues until your mouth understands the taste of many different homes, and your belly is full, so you fall asleep, cradled in the skirts of the world, curled in the lap of peace.
We're relying on the poets today. Our second reading is also from a poet, an English poet, Denise Levertov, Making Peace. A voice from the dark called out, "The poets must give us imagination of peace to oust the intense familiar imagination of disaster. Peace, not only the absence of war. But peace, like a poem, is not there ahead of itself. Can't be imagined before it's made, can't be known except in the words of its making, grammar of justice, syntax of mutual aid. A feeling towards it, dimly sensing a rhythm, is all we have until we begin to utter its metaphors, learning them as we speak. A line of peace might appear if we restructured the sentence of our lives if we restructured the sentence our lives are making, revoked its reaffirmation of profit and power, questioned our needs, allowed long pauses. A cadence of peace might balance its weight on that different fulcrum. Peace, a presence, an energy field more intense than war, might pulse then, stanza by stanza, into the world. Each act of living one of its words, each word a vibration of light, facets of the forming crystal. Whose job is it to give us peace? A voice called out that the poets are the ones who must give us the imagine of peace, to oust the intense familiar imagination of disaster. But the poet replied that peace is like a poem. It doesn't exist before it's created, can't be known except in the words of its own making. She's implying, I think, that the work of creating peace doesn't belong to the poets or the songwriters. I'd add that it doesn't even belong to the politicians and the activists. The work of creating peace belongs to all of us. In our planning work several months ago, one of the worship associates asked some questions which gave rise to the last sermon I offered a couple of weeks ago, as well as to this one, which I think of as kind of fitting together. Where can we find good news in a bad news world? That was the last sermon. Then another question, why don't we know that there is so much peace in the world today? How come we don't tell those stories? A title emerged, even as I wondered if it was true. Peace is breaking out all over. I wanted to know more. And this is what I learned. According to the Center for Systemic Peace, who studies these things, we are, in fact, experiencing less global warfare today than we have in years. One of their reports looks at the number of armed conflicts everywhere in the world starting in the mid-1940s. You can break this down, like they have tons of reports by decades and years and generations. So this one particular report, looking at the 1940s to today, says that global armed conflict peaked in 1992. At that point in time, nearly 30% of the countries in the world were engaged in some kind of political violence, either internally or with another country. In the years since that peak, the number of countries in the world dealing with episodes of political violence has dropped by half. Did you know that? I didn't know that. Azar, yeah, seriously. Azar Ghat is a political scientist, and he's taught all over the world, been a fellow in many places. His home university is in Tel Aviv. And he unpacked this and other related facts in this annual peace address, which is given in Oslo. It's called the PRIO Peace Address. He gave it last year, and he explained that there's been a major reduction in worldwide violence occurring overall in the last two centuries. And we can look at that particular period of time since the 40s, but he traces it back to 1815. Now, we know that there have been significant wars since then. But looking at the trajectory of human history, he sees, looking at the global sweep of human history, a decrease in violence in the last two centuries. He notes that the longest three periods of peace among major modern powers have occurred since then, since 1815. So he offers two explanations for the change. First, he says, states have realized that peace is more profitable than war. Countries are increasingly economically interdependent, and that fact creates economic incentives to maintain peace. Second, he believes, is the global spread of liberal democracy. Vast numbers of people around the world today are socialized to expect that public affairs are peaceful, will be peaceful, and when they're not, that they'll be mediated by law. Accustomed to this at home, we expect it to hold around the world. Believing that most people value life, liberty, and human rights and find war at least undesirable, if not abhorrent. So these two factors, economic interdependence and a globalized values, he says, are contributing to the worldwide decrease in violent warfare. Of course, we know that wars persist, many instigated by our own country and many fought within nations over questions of identity and power. We haven't yet learned the skills we need to usher in a lasting peace, but the fact of increasing peace in the sweep of history can give us hope. In her poem that Bonnie shared with you, Devro Baker, who won an International Poetry Peace Prize for that poem, she says that the bread of peace must bake for a century or more. While it's baking, we can tell stories to stay our hunger. Here's one. Once there was an arts council. They decided to select a jury to judge in a competition amongst artists. And all of the artists were to enter a painting on the subject of peace. The jury looked at all of the contributions and they settled on two entries that they were torn between. One picture was of a calm mountain lake, high up in the mountains, a calm lake surrounded by the towering, peaceful mountains, a blue sky over it with some white, fluffy clouds. Everyone who saw this picture thought it was the perfect picture of peace. The other picture that they were deciding between also had mountains, but these mountains were rugged and bare on top. Above them was a stormy sky from which rain fell and on which lightning played. Down the side of the mountain was a rushing waterfall foaming down the side of the mountain. There was something about it that wasn't entirely peaceful, but what captured their imagination was behind that waterfall. You had to look closely at the painting to see it. But behind that waterfall, there was a crack in the mountain. And in the crack in the mountain, there was a nest. And on the nest, there was a bird with babies. There, in the midst of the rush of the water, sat the mother bird protecting her baby birds. So the jury chose that painting to win the prize because they explained peace does not mean to be in a place where there's no noise, where everything's placid, there's no trouble. Peace means to be in the midst of the trouble, in the midst of the noise, and still be calm in your heart. That's the real meaning of peace. So maybe there will never come a time when the world is safe from war and violent conflict, but we can learn how to be peaceful amidst whatever conflicts there may be. Even in the midst of fighting, we can learn to be peaceful. As in so many things, we must begin with ourselves. The Unitarian Universalist Association's Statement of Conscience on Peacemaking avows that this is true and encourages all of us to develop spiritual practices that will help us cultivate inner peace. There are so many: meditation, prayer, contemplative reading, Tai Chi, writing, chanting, yoga. So many of the spiritual practices we might pursue offer us tangible benefits of greater peacefulness, wholeness, and ease. That's where we begin, recognizing it is just the beginning, because we live in communities. We don't live by ourselves. Thus, we must learn how to cultivate peace in our relationships. For this, too, there are concrete practices that we might pursue. In fact, a member of the congregation, Saunas Parsons, just taught a class about this a couple of weeks ago for those who attended the annual summer camp that many in this congregation attend called Summer Institute. The class was about how do we cultivate peace in our personal relationships when there's conflict, when we don't agree on something. Stress. There are skills. This isn't just a matter of luck. Some people aren't lucky in relationships and other people are unlucky. Some people are skilled and we can learn those skills. Congregations are an excellent place to learn skills and also an excellent place to practice. I've said before that when people ask what Unitarian Universalists believe, it's not the right question. We believe lots of things, each of us guided by our own search for truth and meaning, sometimes things that are opposed to one another. What binds us together is not our beliefs, but our promises. We're a covenantal religious tradition, united by promises we make to live with one another, together, in peace, despite our differences, encouraging each and every person to grow into their best selves. Part of being our best selves involves being peaceful with one another, even with the people in the community who we wouldn't necessarily choose as friends. So you can think about congregational life as an excellent laboratory to practice peace. The skills we develop internally in our intimate relationships, in our beloved communities, are skills that we can take out with us into the larger society. Of course, those skills are not on their own enough to create peaceful societies. To be at peace, societies need justice and equity in human relationships. The forces that create injustice and preserve inequity are systemic forces for the most part. We can't undo those systemic forces simply by interacting peacefully with one another. They're larger than individual actions. But we can use our skills to work to try to change those systems. The same goes for our collective relationship with the web of life, which we're all a part of. We can't have peace when we're poisoning our earth. But we can use our skills to be part of the change we want to see in the way humanity understands its relationship to the earth. In our own society, the effects of systems of domination and oppression on people and the earth are significant contributors to the violence that we have yet to undo. Another contributor is the effect of those systems of domination and oppression on our relationships with one another, effects which too often fuel senseless violence. Now, that may sound a little academic and abstract, so let me make this concrete. In his book, Violence, the psychologist James Gilligan asked prisoners what they wanted so badly that they would sacrifice anything to get it. One inmate declared, "Pride, dignity, self-esteem, and I'll kill every other person in this cell block to get it if I have to." That's what he said. Another one said this, "I've got to have my self-respect, and I've declared war on the whole world until I get it." The first principle of Unitarian Universalism affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person, but so many people are not feeling it. You know that. Not feeling worthy in the eyes of society, not feeling as though their dignity has been respected. Part of that goes back to those systems of domination and oppression which keep people down. But part of that goes to the way that well-meaning people accept and sometimes enforce those very systems of domination and oppression that we, in principle, in theory, if you asked us, would deny. So, for example, most of us believe that racism is wrong and harmful. And yet, many white people have not learned how to deal effectively with the toxic white privilege we're afforded, which works to keep racism in place. Often, we're not even aware that we're being granted white privilege, but the impact of that privilege has an effect just the same, whether we're aware or not. So what do we do? How can we find peaceful means of challenging the effects of systems of domination and oppression in our interactions with one another? I'll give you another story which might offer some insight. This one comes from several pioneering public schools looking for better ways to promote peace in school communities. After the shooting in Columbine, Colorado, many school systems adopted a kind of philosophy of intervention that many police departments around the country were adopting. And that philosophy said, if you get people and intervene when they're committing minor crimes or causing minor problems in school, then you can prevent major problems later on. So it was kind of a crackdown on minor crime and minor problems in schools. So the result of that policy in many public schools, especially big urban public schools around the country, has been an increase in disciplinary action against students, which has disproportionately affected people of color. In a major study coming out of Texas 2 years ago, researchers found that 89% of African American boys and 74% of Hispanic and Latino boys had been cited for at least one violation of the rules in their schools, as compared to 59% of white boys. Now, this is an escalation overall. Those are huge numbers. This is between 7th grade and 12th grade. That more than half of all of the boys had been cited for infractions of the school's code of conduct. And you can see the disproportionate effect on kids of color. Those same figures, though lower overall, the same pattern applied for girls. Concern that the rate of disciplinary action might be having unintended consequences of telling kids that they're bad, some schools have experimented with alternative approaches. One of the most successful so far is based on the restorative justice model. This is a model that's coming out of really innovative communities. Minneapolis is one of the first that has experimented with this. And this approach, restorative justice, the idea is that people who have committed some kind of crime or infraction can be brought into alignment with the community more effectively by being asked to understand themselves, why they did the action, the impact that action had on other people, and then seeking means of reconciliation rather than just meting out punishment. So the goal is to help a person become more self-aware, more other aware, and then to repair the breach. In this way, people who make mistakes are being guided into the community rather than away from the community. Instead of communicating to the person who did something wrong that they are bad or wrong, they get the message that their actions were bad or wrong, and they are enlisted as partners in finding solutions that can make things right. This approach resonates with an idea, a really challenging idea, that I know some of you have heard of and maybe don't accept from the Reverend Bill Schultz. He was a minister here when he was a student at Oberlin in the 60s and the early 70s. Later in his career, he became the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association for 8 years and then the executive director of Amnesty International for 12. He's now the executive director of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. A few years ago, when he resigned from Amnesty and came back to work for the UUA, he delivered a major lecture entitled, What Torture Has Taught Me. In that lecture, he explained that he's come to believe that our first principle is a myth, a useful myth, but a myth nonetheless. He says that worth and dignity are not inherent. No, he says, inherency is a construct, a useful myth designed to cover up the fact that we're all sinners and that we're not always certain which sins and therefore which sinners are worse than others. Each of us has to be assigned worth, he says. It doesn't come automatically and taught to behave with dignity. The way we do this, he continues, is by referencing the values of the larger community. The larger community wants people to be treated with respect, to have a sense of their own worth and the assurance of their own dignity. And so if this is to come to pass, we have to defend the right of each person to be treated as worthy and insist that all people have the opportunity to learn how to live their lives with dignity. It seems to me that the restorative justice efforts in some schools are after just that. And I think that there's something to that idea. I believe that every child is born precious, whole, holy, and yet so many children grow up to be youth and later adults who commit cruelty and violence. How might society be different if we aggressively endeavored to be sure that every child was deeply aware, not only of her own worth, but also the worth of everyone else in her community? What would it look like if we gave each child the resources, both the internal resources and the external resources, to learn what it means to live with dignity? Perhaps these are among the tools we need to help usher in a deeper and more abiding peace in society at large. The poet says that the bread has to bake for at least a century, so we have time for another story. This one comes from Afghanistan. It's a story about the Afghan Peace Volunteers. This was an organization founded in 2008 by a man named Dr. Hakim. He was a medical doctor from Singapore who had been educated in Gandhian nonviolent principles. He decided to do a tour of duty working in a refugee camp in Afghanistan as a medical doctor. A refugee camp for Afghans in Pakistan as a medical doctor. Over the course of the 2 years that he was there, he developed significant relationships and was really moved by the experiences of the people that he encountered. And so he decided to move to Afghanistan after that tour of duty. And he started teaching a course at a university in Afghanistan about peace. 55 young people enrolled, representing various Afghan ethnicities and tribes. And he invited them as part of the course to consider living together for a semester. 16 of the 55 students took him up on the offer, and they represented 5 different tribal and ethnic groups. The experience the students shared were so profound that it led to the creation of this group, Afghan Peace Volunteers, a group for young people guided by the vision of all ethnic groups in Afghanistan uniting for a nonviolent movement towards a peaceful life. This group has engaged in just, it's been a relatively short time, but they have engaged in so many powerful actions that have made a significant difference in their own lives and the lives of their community. These include posting signs in a public park. The signs say things like, "Why not love? Why not peace?" And when the signs are vandalized, they replace them and put them back up, creating this little park of peace in the middle of that community. In another project, a group of Afghan youth made 100 cell phone covers for another group of ethnic Afghan youth that they did not know. And they wrote on each, they inscribed on each cell phone cover the word peace in the language of that other ethnic Afghan group and sent them to them. And then they followed them up with phone calls to these youth that they didn't know. Just to say, we have something in common. Let's find out what that is, to try to open a dialogue. They've had peace marches, participated in peace ceremonies, and a few of them even went on a peace pilgrimage to India. The youth have a statement of their aims on their website. I'd like to share it with you. It says, "Some say this journey to peace will likely meet failure. They say genuine humanity, equality, and peace belong only to the poets and the fables. These are utopian ideals that our human beings are not capable of reaching. A practical love in the public arena is impossible." It's sad that so many people believe this, because both Afghans and the world are waiting for a public practice of humanity, equality, and nonviolence. It's sad because reality, perhaps life itself, seems keen for us to remain frozen in the timid belief that the world cannot have humane relations, which most people want. We wish to address our own cynicism, to try to face our own disappointment, to take small steps, believing that when we embark on our journey to smile, our humanity will grow and will not shrink back to its unsure and undignified days. As a result of this journey, we won't be the same again. Under other influences, these youth might grow up to be part of the conflict. Instead, they're learning to be part of the peace. There are so many good stories. I could tell you good stories all day. So you know them too. Tell them to one another. Tell the good stories about peace. Inspired by those stories, let us be stories. Let us create good stories in which we are actors, in which our families and our communities are actors in the stories of peace. The stories will become the poems of peace, which, like all other poems, can't be known except in the words of its making. A feeling towards it, dimly sensing a rhythm, is all we have, says the poet, until we begin to utter its metaphors, learning them as we speak. A line of peace might appear if we restructured the sentence our lives are making, revoked its reaffirmation of profit and power, questioned our needs, allowed long pauses. A cadence of peace might balance its weight on that different fulcrum, peace. A presence, an energy field more intense than war might pulse then, stanza by stanza, into the world, each act of living one of its words, each word a vibration of light, facets of the forming crystal. May we be part of that creation. Amen. This beloved community is so special. And it is a community that we create together. We, with our time and our talent and our treasure, make it what it is. There are so many ways in which people contribute. This morning, I'd like to lift up just one way and thank Jesse Young for filling in. Where are you, Jesse? For the last 2 months. Your wonderful work allowed Hal Walker, our music director, to take a leave, and Hal will be back with us next Sunday. If you are a guest this morning, we have a gift for you as a token of our welcome. There's a candle in the basket. The offering will now be gratefully received. We have gathered in witness to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.